From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Both Republicans and Democrats are finding something to cheer about in primary voting results yesterday in eight states. President Trump tweeted congratulations this morning to businessman John Cox, who will face California Lieutenant Governor Gavin Newsom in the governor's race in November in that state. And it appears that Democrats did not get shut out of crowded congressional races in the state's so-called jungle primary, where the top two vote-getters, no matter the party, move on.
Let's bring in our political strategists. Today joining us are Jamal Simmons, Democratic strategist, and Paris Denard, Republican strategist who serves on a Trump Fellowship Commission. Welcome to both of you. And Jamal, let me start with you. What's your takeaway from yesterday's primaries?
Well, it looks like what happened, first of all, thank you for having me. It looks like what happened was that, again, the Democrats were able to survive in a couple of places, but they were a little bit worried that you might get a couple of Republicans who were in the final two. This primary is crazy in California, where it's the top two finishers of any party that get to make it to the final ballot.
Democrats were worried about Orange County in particular.
So they were worried about Orange County. And it also looks like in the governor's race, where Republicans may have been worried, Antonio Villagrosa did not make it into the final two. So as you just said, President Trump congratulated the Republican nominee. So we're going to have a spirited contest in California, which is good for turnout, and it's good for Democrats.
Paris?
Look, I think that all this talk about a Democratic blue wave being strong and was not – we didn't see that prevail in California. And I think when you look outside of California, well, staying on California, you know, you had the GOP flips the California legislative seat down in Orange County with the Assemblywoman Ling Chang. And then if you look at outside of just California as it is, looking at West Virginia, Republican turnout was up 61% compared to 2014 in Ohio. Up 48% compared to 2014, in Indiana up 43%. So I think when you tie the enthusiasm that we're seeing on the Reds on the Republican side with the resources that the Republican National Committee has and the dysfunction on the side of the DNC with their issues with Ellison and Bernie Sanders, and they're endorsing people in New York and they shouldn't, and all these things, and I think there is and the economy being going so well for many Americans, I think that the idea that there's a massive blue wave is not as strong looking at the results.
Well, Jamal,
tonight.
Doesn't Paris make a point, too, that Trump voters are also punishing Republicans? I mean, you have the Alabama Republican Congresswoman Martha Roby. She didn't clinch her nomination. She's headed to a July 17th runoff, and it's speculation that she was punished by Republicans for not backing candidate Trump after that tape of him bragging about grabbing women's parts came out. So, you know, does Paris have a point that, you know, still support for Trump is strong, the administration touting the lowest unemployment numbers in nearly two decades?
You will not hear me say this very often, but you are correct. Paris might be right.
I'm recording that.
Yeah, exactly. I think the world is. Here's why. I do think there will be a blue wave, but there will also be a red wave. Here's what we know. The Trump forces are ascendant in the Republican Party. And it's very hard to win a Republican nomination while standing against Donald Trump in the Republican Party. The question that we all need to pay attention to next is, what does that mean in the general election when the Republicans are running against another alternative? And it's not a Republican-on-Republican fight. It's a Republican versus a Democrat. And there are a lot of people who just don't agree with the kind of government, the kind of society that Donald Trump is waging. And Donald Trump very clearly is running a culture war, is not running on the economy. He's talking about immigration. He's talking about the flag and the national anthem. He's denigrating people of color. He is running a culture war. That culture war has a lot of people who are ready to fight it, and we'll see what happens in the red versus blue wave in November.
He's also on a pardoning spree right now, and we're hearing about potentially another one today that was brought on because of his meeting with Kim Kardashian. A lot of people believe, Paris, that he is doing this. He's pardoning so many people because he is worried about what some other people might tell the special counsel, Robert Mueller, about him, and he wants to send a signal that he will pardon them. Is that your sense?
So if you look at the case of Jack Johnson, I don't see how you can have any correlation between Jack Johnson and what's going on.
The boxer,
He was the first African-American heavyweight boxing champ.
What about Dinesh D'Souza? Or, you know, so he's talked about Rod Blagojevich in Illinois. He's talked about Martha Stewart.
Or a friend of Kim Kardashian.
Right.
So you can pick and choose the pardons that you want, but let's talk about Jack Johnson.
No. Are there any others?
Well, I'm talking about the ones that the president has actually pardoned. And I think that when you look at the pardon of Dinesh D'Souza, for instance, a lot of people on the Republican right feel that there was a political prosecution. If you look at the pardon that the White House just announced, that woman had a very compelling story. And I think that's what we want our president to do, look at compelling stories and say if there is injustice, if there is something that is wrong, the president should commute
the sentence.
What
about Joe Arpaio?
The president, again, felt that Joe Arpaio was a victim of political persecution. And I think that
So you don't think it has anything to do with the Mueller investigation is what you're saying?
I don't think the Joe Arpaio pardon months ago has anything to do with the Mueller investigation, mm-hmm. where the president is not under investigation.
I want to jump
in. I think
in.
That you look at these yeah. things, it's just unseemly to look at the lives that have been impacted by these issues. And that's why the president is tackling things like prison reform and say, oh, it's only because of the Mueller investigation that Jack Johnson has been given the pardon that is long overdue, that President Obama never gave, that and others never gave, despite the fact that they campaigned constantly throughout many administrations to have this done.
I think people are talking about more recent pardons, but I want to
get on to... Jack Johnson was a recent pardon.
No. Just in the last week or so. But I do want to move on. You're going to love this, Paris.
The one that happened today was a recent pardon, which is one that was justified.
Paris, you're going to love this because, Jamal, I want to ask you about Bill Clinton. So last night, CBS Late Show host Stephen Colbert gave former President Bill Clinton a do-over after Clinton's first attempt at responding to a question about his affair with White House intern Monica Lewinsky. You know, in the light of this new Me Too moment that we're in, Clinton in that first questioning sounded more annoyed than apologetic. People wondered why he wasn't more prepared for the question as he goes out on a book tour. And Clinton told Colbert last night that wasn't his finest hour. Let's listen.
I apologize to my family, to Monica Lewinsky and her family, to the American people. I meant it then. I meant it now. I've had to live with the consequences every day since. And I still believe this Me Too movement is long overdue, necessary, and should be supported. And we should all...
Now, Jamal, Colbert said, with all due respect, your behavior was the most famous example of a powerful man sexually misbehaving in the workplace in my lifetime. What would you advise now? Here's Bill Clinton popping up on a book tour right, you know, before the midterms, drawing attention away from other things that are happening. What would you advise happen in this moment?
I would advise that Bill Clinton do what he did, which is to accept responsibility and to apologize to people. And I would advise that the Congress of the United States hold Donald Trump and Clarence Thomas to the same standard that they held Bill Clinton to and go after their impropriety. What we know is we have a president of the United States who is a clear misogynist who said really disruptive things. We also know that Clarence Thomas was the Supreme Court Justice of the United States of America, probably perjured himself in front of the Judiciary Committee when he was talking about the Anita Hill situation. And he was not held accountable for that. And so I'm happy to talk about Bill Clinton as long as we talk about Clarence Thomas and his own problems. Because I think
Paris, does Bill Clinton make people think of Donald Trump, or does it not matter with Donald Trump because many people don't hold him to the same standard?
Well, I think there's a clear difference. One, President Clinton was president at the time that these allegations happened. President Clinton was the sitting United States president when he lied under oath, and President Clinton was impeached for it. I think the Congress heard it.
That's right. He paid a penalty for that.
He did. That's millions of dollars as well. And so I think it's right to draw those conclusions about President Clinton. And he has to live with what he did and did not do. And so does Secretary Clinton for how she treated all of the accusers, including Monica Lewinsky and people like Juanita Broderick, how they publicly engaged in a character assassination of these people. But
Clarence Thomas has never had to answer again for what he did with Anita Thomas and Anita Hill in any substantive way. And he probably perjured himself in front of the Judiciary Committee.
If the United States Senate felt that Clarence Thomas was not worthy of being United States Supreme Court Justice, he would not be a sitting United States Supreme Court justice.
You think the Republican Senate would go after a conservative justice, even knowing today what's happened in the Me Too movement? Even though the Democrats got rid of Al Franken because of what he did, would the Republicans actually go after a conservative judge?
I think that when you look back in the past and what happened, you know, the Republicans stood up against Richard Nixon and encourage him to do the right thing. And so the Republican Party has no problem doing that when we think that it's right. But I think that if you're going to play that litmus test, then you can look at what they did with Al Franken or look at what they did with other sitting members of the Congress and the Senate on the Democrat side. What this all talks about is the hypocrisy of the left. When you point fingers at Republicans and talk about Republicans do this, Republicans do that, there's about 15 to 20 Democrats have done the same thing. And so if you want there, if you want to be fair and do this Me Too movement and all these accusations, remember, it's going to play on the right and it's going to play on the left.
Jamal, take 10 seconds here. Yeah, go ahead.
Clinton was impeached for perjury or suspicion of perjury. If Clarence Thomas was investigated for whether or not he perjured himself in front of the Judiciary Committee, I think then we could have a fair conversation.
But my point is being made. Bill Clinton is taking the oxygen out of the room.
I guess so, yes. We're still talking about the events of 20 years ago, but here we are today in 2018. Jamal Simmons and Paris Denard, thanks to both of you.
Thank you so much.
An unlikely union is taking place across the country. Drug users, primarily opioid users, are banding together, unionizing, to fight the stigma of their drug use, whether they're trying to quit or still using. They're pushing for ways to bring people out of the shadows, to teach them how to use more safely, something called harm reduction, with needle exchanges, overdose reversal drugs like Narcan, safe use sites. And they're fighting drug-induced homicide laws, which punish the people who sell drugs that lead to fatalities. Drug users unions have formed in California, Washington, North Carolina. Jess Tilley is founder of the New England Users Union. As she'll explain, she's not using now. Can't say she won't again, but if she does, it will be safely, something that's controversial in recovery circles. She joins us now. Jess Tilley, welcome.
Hello.
I want to start with talking about you. You started using heroin at a very young age, and it was initially not a very pretty picture.
No, not at all. And I mean, I initially started at 15, and I always tell the story about coming back to school when I was 15 and realizing that probably nobody in my high school had injected heroin that weekend. That's where the stigma first began. And by 18, my two closest friends were completely strung out, and I actually had this animosity for heroin. However, within the next year, I would be sexually assaulted, and I turned to heroin. It was my first drug, and it was the only thing that allowed me to feel present without actually having to be present, if that makes sense. However, my use got very chaotic because I was using alone and in secrecy, as many drug users do. And when I found harm reduction, I realized I didn't have to be ashamed because I was injecting a substance into my body. This is the misconception with harm reduction. I was taught that it is heroin, it can kill you, but there are ways to use safely until I was able to reach that point where I wanted to stop. People always think recovery is either you're completely abstinent or you're in full chaotic use, and there is a world in between. Everybody's recovery looks a little bit different.
But you know what you sound like to people who work in recovery. You know, you sound like the person who says, yeah, I can go back and use if I just, you know, have these things in place, and that's a dangerous message to send because most people can't.
I always make the point to say I know I'm not infallible. Like, I know that if I use too many days in a row, I'm right back where I was years ago. I'm also realized that I'm at a high risk for overdose because I'm a recreational user, if anything. So it's a very thin line that we walk. However, I feel as an outed drug user, I speak for the people who can't speak for themselves. I want people to realize that they don't have to be alone in this.
Well, talk about that. Talk about the world of harm reduction. What do you mean by that?
So in the world of harm reduction, it's any positive change. If somebody, say, is injecting five times a day and we are able, and I say we as harm reductionists, are able to help them achieve a goal, maybe their goal is using two times a day, or maybe they want to stop injecting and just sniff. To us, that's a positive change. I call it like the pre-treatment phase or pre-contemplation, where I've always seen this in every person I've worked with in harm reduction. There comes a point where they realize their lives are way too chaotic or their use is just uncontrollable and they want to stop. However, that stopping may not be for the rest of their lives. It may just be for a month. It may be for, you know, a period of 3 years, and then they may try using again. And this is where the judgment comes in. And this is where I see people fall into the gaps and die, because when that time comes, they tend to be using alone. I always talk about people using behind closed doors and dying because they're so ashamed of that stigma that comes upon a person who chooses to pick up again. That's where I differ in my life. That's where I don't have that shame anymore. Like, I will talk about it. Like, if I decide to use again, I make sure I have people around me. I make sure there's a plan in place that I've talked to. I'd say my support, my network, and that's what keeps me alive.
Your point is that in having a union, in making it something that people are acknowledging by joining a group, it will take away the behind closed doors usage, which is where people overdose alone and die.
And that they do have rights. And we as drug users are treated as second class citizens. When we have a president that is talking about life imprisonment or murdering drug dealers, I mean, most drug dealers in this country now are middle class white Americans who are selling to support their own habit. They are the children of parents that are speaking and saying, we want drug dealers killed. They don't realize it's their own kids who are dealing.
You also say some of these tough policies, mandatory 20-year minimum prison sentences, for instance, that's in Southern California. Rhode Island lawmakers are looking to pass a similar law prosecuting drug dealers for murder. You say if that's the case, then if a drug dealer is sitting with a user and that user overdoses, the drug dealer might be less likely to get help because they will
exactly
be convicted.
Or friends, even if a friend is in a room. I mean, I think about back in my years of using, I would have been considered a drug dealer because I was procuring drugs for friends. Now, if a friend had overdosed in the room with me and I knew that I was going to go to jail for the rest of my life, you know, I mean, me personally, my morals, I would take that chance. But there are plenty of people who are terrified or they're afraid to stay with the person until help comes. And right now we are really trying to combat what you mentioned in the beginning, the induced homicide law. We are going to put forth a living will and testament that we would like everyone to sign, whether you be you're a drug user, you might consider doing drugs, if you're a loved one of somebody who's doing drugs, that if they should die, that nobody can be charged with their murder or our murder. We're saying, like, say my best friend sold me drugs and I died, but I asked for those drugs. I would not want my best friend going to prison for the rest of her life. You know, there's going to be pushback, we realize this, or, you know, there's definitely situations that would not fall within this. It's more of a statement that we're trying to make. I mean, I understand I've lost close friends, and my immediate reaction was to blame the person until I realized, like, that could have been me.
But what else does a union do to help people who maybe are struggling, who are out of control in their use? What else would you do?
What we do as a union is we come together, we allow people to share their experiences, to talk about the stigmatization. We address mistreatment of drug users at emergency rooms, in housing.
Talk about some of those things that happen.
People who have housing and that may have had a child that overdosed in their house cannot call 911 because they'll lose their housing. Think about how terrifying that is for a parent. Or somebody who's in school, who's on scholarship, they can't call 911, or their friend can't call 911 because that person will lose their scholarship. Every choice we make, we're thinking about our own safety and how not to be persecuted by the society that we live in. I try to say, instead of drug user organizing, I say community organizing, because we're a community that actually stands up for itself.
Yeah. How do you pay for this?
So I do have a grant, and it allowed me to finally be able to pay myself a very small amount, but also, more importantly, to pay peers to do the work. And so we have peers going out and doing street outreach. And as far as getting my supplies and naloxone and fentanyl test strips, it has either come out of my own pocket or out of donations and from other harm reduction programs. Been so supportive.
You have these test trips to show people how to test their drugs to make sure the deadly fentanyl isn't in it.
Yes. And what is great about these test strips, I mean, we tell everybody to approach every drug because we're finding a lot of cocaine with fentanyl in it, which is really dangerous for recreational drug users who have never done an opiate because they're not expecting to have fentanyl put into their system. But what the fentanyl test strips allow is dialogue to happen. I've seen time and time again where people who swore up and down that they knew their supply, that there was no fentanyl, when they actually had the tangible evidence of using the strip, their behavior has changed so much around drug use. There's been such an uptick in Narcan distribution where people are requesting it and parents are requesting it. Loved ones of drug users are requesting it because people know that they're at such high risk for overdose now. Yeah. And people are not using alone anymore as much. So this is one another thing that the fentanyl test strips have allowed us as harm reductionists, as outreach workers, to really address this stigmatization about, like, look, it may be upsetting to talk about that you're relapsed or that you're using again, but you could also die. Like, this is a choice here. That's why I say I don't advocate people using. I advocate for people to have a choice around their use, if that makes sense. And I advocate for people to be able to talk about their drug use and not hide and be in shame.
Well, what do you say to people who say that these harm reduction methods, whether they're primarily Narcan to reverse overdoses, that what they do is that they allow people to use over and over and over again? I mean, there's examples of people who've been revived 20 times, and that the money should be put into helping people stop completely.
I'm all for treatment. I'm all for getting more beds for treatment. But I've also been hearing this for 20 years. We need more beds. We need more treatment. And you know what I've seen? More places shut down. When I have people, my program participants, who are calling me and telling me they've been on wait lists for weeks, what do they do? So, and when people tell me, like, oh, harm reduction is enabling, I'm like, it's enabling people to live another day. It's enabling people to get to that point where they can enter treatment when they want to.
Are you also saying that the reality is that some people may not ever want to? So why not help?
Exactly. And, you know, is that what I want for people? No. Do I want people to go through the chaotic hell I went through in my severe active use? Absolutely not. And I think that's part of what being in a union does, too. We have younger people that come in that we can share these experiences of what we went through. Keep in mind, we have a lot of people in the union who are former users who just don't feel comfortable being in NA or AA. So this is a form of support for them, too, where they're giving back to the community.
That's Jess Tilley, founder of the New England Users Union. There are other drug users unions springing up across the country. Jess, thank you so much, and best of luck to you.
Thank you.
Ever get to Friday, look back on the week, and say to yourself, what just happened? I'm Sam Sanders. Check out my podcast, It's Been a Minute, where every Friday we catch up on the news and the culture of the week and try to make sense of it all. Listen on the NPR One app or wherever you get your podcast.
There are now more job openings in the U.S. than people looking for work, according to the Labor Department. It's the first time that's happened since this kind of record-keeping began in 2000. The unemployment rate is also at its lowest level since then, 3.8%. So what are the implications of such a tight labor market? Maggie Lake hosts CNN Money with Maggie Lake. She joins us now. Hi, Maggie.
Hi, Jeremy.
So at the end of April, there were 6.7 million job openings and fewer, 6.3 million people looking for work. What's happening?
Well, a couple of things. We have a robust economy, finally, and so companies are starting to pick up their hiring. But we also have a shrinking labor force, right? Less people just available to work. Now, some of that's because baby boomers are retiring. We know they were such a big demographic. But many people are also blaming the opioid crisis. And I think this is really interesting. Executives are getting a lot more vocal about the fact that they just can't find applicants who can pass a drug test. I mean, that is really shocking. And I think one of the reasons that I'm seeing more and more economists starting to talk about this, it's not just a health epidemic, it's becoming an economic problem as well.
I am walking by stores and restaurants here and there, and I see signs that say we're hiring, which, you know, we remember 10 years ago, 8 years ago during the crisis, you didn't see that kind of thing.
That's right.
What are the industries where there is a real labor shortage right now?
You know, from some of the stuff I've seen recently in some of the most recent government reports, hospitality, retail, which is interesting because retail you tend to think is struggling, healthcare, we know about the needs because of those baby boomers. But I have to tell you, I've heard from trucking, construction, fast food, even on the high end in high tech. I mean, there is a talent war there. So I feel like this is pretty broad-based. And regionally, when you look at it, again, everywhere but the U.S. Midwest has a lot more vacancies than the coast.
And what about people who have jobs? Are they seeing their wages go up because of this tight labor market?
You know, it's interesting. You would think so, and we are seeing wages go up finally, and that's really good news, but not in the way that you would have expected or that we saw in the past with this level of unemployment. And I think one thing that's really going on here is automation. You know, raises tend to get baked in. They're hard to pull down when the economy slows, so companies are reluctant. And a lot of companies taking a look at this and saying, gee, if I have to really hike wages, would it be more cost effective for me to put in robots or automated machines to do this? And we're not just talking about factories, by the way. I mean, I went in over Easter break to McDonald's, and the entire ordering was through kiosks. It's the first time I'd seen that. And, you know, we know from artificial intelligence and big data, right, that's taking some white-collar jobs. So this is an issue across the economy, and I think it's one that we don't spend enough time talking about, especially in Washington.
So are we at the point where people are secure in leaving their jobs to hunt for another one, or do they still want to hold on to that job that they have?
I think because of the wage issue, we're not seeing that really competitive labor market. I mean, if wages aren't going up that much, are you going to uproot your whole family or, you know, leave the comfort of what's known for something else? I mean, you want that risk to have a payoff, right? The other thing is, in order to do that in the U.S., sometimes it means moving geography. I just mentioned Midwest has got a lot more openings. Are you going to uproot your family to go there? It depends on if you're underwater in your house still or what housing costs are. You know, so there's a lot of factors at play, but we're not seeing that big competitive mobility that we'd seen in the past as well. Those are still the elements that are lagging, even though jobs is a good news story right now.
Maggie Lake with CNN Money with Maggie Lake. Thank you.
Thanks, Jeremy.
It's D-Day, June 6th, the 74th anniversary of a day many overlook, but there's not a soldier alive who was there who could ever forget. As part of the Allied invasion, boatloads of seasick U.S. troops landed on the beaches of Normandy, France, under the withering fire of Germans on the heavily fortified cliffs above. Norman Grossman was a 19-year-old Army private from Newton, Massachusetts, and was there.
We thought that we would land on the beach, that the Higgins boat would open on the beach and the ramp would go down and we would run out onto sand and then be able to run across the beach, and we would have resistance but not as much as we encountered. What happened is the Higgins boat couldn't get all the way in. Most of us landed into water which was probably waist deep. We had so much equipment. I had to shed a lot of equipment right away. I mean, this gas-impregnated clothing was so heavy that we had. I just threw away the gas mask. I kept a little food, my shovel and my rifle. It's the only way I could move, and I ran across the beach.
Norman Grossman, the Army private who landed on Omaha on D-Day, made it across the beach when so many others didn't. It was June 6, 1944, and an invasion that Hitler knew was coming. Thousands of ships, thousands of aircraft, and, of course, thousands of men. But its eventual success boiled down to small actions performed by many individuals, and it came with a horrible cost. Historian John McManus offers a minute-by-minute account of this day 74 years ago in his book, The Dead and Those About to Die, D-Day, the Big Red One at Omaha Beach. We spoke in 2014. And boy, the stories. I'm stuck on one about the radio man, John Joseph Pinder, whose face was blown apart. He holds it together with one hand while wading in the water to get a radio the size and weight of a window air conditioner with the other hand. Just amazing. And we want to hear more of these stories. But first, some background. The Big Red One, that's the nickname for the 1st Infantry Division?
That's correct. The 1st Division was heavily combat experienced by the time of D-Day. It had fought in North Africa. It had fought in Sicily. It knew a lot about amphibious invasions, and that's why the division is chosen to lead the way at Omaha Beach, which the planners knew was going to be a very tough nut to crack. So the division had this pride, but also a kind of a resentment that they always seemed to get the tough jobs.
Yeah, well, and this one of the toughest. Why was it necessary? Remind us.
Omaha Beach is extremely important because it's kind of the nexus of the Allied beachheads. You have the British and Canadian beachheads to the east, and then you have the main American beach to the west at Utah Beach. So Omaha had to be taken if the two were ever to join up and the Allies were to break out of Normandy.
Well, and if you've seen the beginning of the film Saving Private Ryan, you know how withering this was. That film is about as close as you can come to experiencing, we hear, what it was like there. But you've collected stories of men from the 1st Division about what they experienced. Just give us the overarching. I mean, you say there were cowards, there were heroes, but a lot of heroes you will never hear about.
Right. There's hundreds you'll never hear about because they were killed and no one saw what they did, or whoever saw what they did never talked about it and never made it into the records. I mean, who knows? So what I try to do is give you a new look at Omaha Beach because we tend to know a lot about what happens on the western side, the 29th Division, the Rangers, what's portrayed in Saving Private Ryan. And so I kind of see this as the rest of the story.
Yeah. And when I said cowards, that was a word that you used, but it's hard to, you know, everybody was heroic and brave just to be there. Just stunningly impossible. One 1st Division officer, Joe Dawson, said men were pinned down on the beach mentally, if not physically. There was this sense that they were frozen in fear because the fire was coming from everywhere. But then the title of your book becomes important, The Dead and Those About to Die. Why?
Yeah, this is the phrase that we most commonly associate with Omaha Beach in the long run. And it comes from Colonel George Taylor, who commanded the 16th Infantry Regiment, which was the lead unit for the 1st Division on D-Day morning. And Taylor had not come up with this spontaneously. He had actually written just that very phrase about 8 months before when he was talking about amphibious invasions. He was quite an expert on it. He had led them in the Mediterranean. And so when he comes ashore about 2 hours after H hour, this idea of only two kinds of people are going to be on this beach, the dead and those who are going to die, is foremost in his mind to the point of obsession. So he's walking up and down the beach under intense fire, making sure that people do something. What he was telling them is time is not on your side. If you stay here, you're probably going to die. He really does save a lot of lives that morning by just kind of motivating people and giving them a sense of just doing something.
Well, and let's talk about others who saved lives. I mentioned Joe Pinder, a former minor league pitcher, now a radio man. I'm just stunned by your description of what he did.
Joe Pinder is part of the headquarters group, the advance headquarters group that goes in about an hour after the initial wave of the invasion. And he understands very, very much that communications are going to be important for anything to happen in Omaha Beach. So he has this kind of commitment to his equipment. He was a combat experienced soldier. And what strikes me is that, you know, he was badly wounded as he's, you know, dragging in the equipment and the waves and still keeps doing it.
He holds his face together.
The Army recognized his valor by conferring the Medal of Honor on him. And, of course, you know, he did not survive D-Day, unfortunately.
There were three Medals of Honor that day. Joe Pinder, posthumously. Private Carlton Barrett, what did he do?
He's with this very small advanced detachment that goes in with the 16th Infantry early on D-Day morning. And his job was really to kind of look around and figure out what should be good routes to get off the beach for his regiment when they came in. But instead, he ends up enmeshed in the crisis that morning because things were so bad. He ends up moving all around the beach, saving lives of wounded men, motivating people to keep moving, dragging wounded people in from the surf, which was very dangerous because the waterline was where the heaviest fire tended to be, and it's where a lot of the wounded were lying there as the waves started coming in. And so Barrett is just all over the place that morning. And what he does so impresses all the people who saw him, you know, that he ends up earning the Medal of Honor. And fortunately, he survived the war.
Jimmy Monteith?
Jimmy Monteith was a young lieutenant, and he has a really interesting story, too. He came from a fairly well-off family in Virginia that had a tradition of going to Virginia Tech. And he had gone there, and he hadn't done that well in college. He wasn't the most focused student. He was sort of the beloved baby, but they weren't in the family. They weren't sure what was going to become of him. Well, he kind of finds himself in the Army. And in the Battle of Sicily, he had already emerged as a very brave and well-regarded small unit leader. And on D-Day, he is one of the key figures in securing the whole eastern side of Omaha Beach. And the reason that was important is the German defenders on the eastern side of Omaha Beach were in a position to basically shoot everybody along the whole span of 4.5 miles that comprises Omaha Beach. Monteith's actions are able to kind of negate that. And he ends up getting killed, unfortunately, staving off a German counterattack in the course of the day. He was very highly regarded by the soldiers of his platoon.
He attacked the attackers. Things went wrong, as you point out. Landings were delayed. Some of the craft were far from where they were supposed to be. The men had too much equipment. The concern was that they'd need it later, but really they should have been a lighter force. But still, this incredible ultimate success, but at unbelievable cost. What are you thinking about on this day?
Well, I do think of the cost. I went through and calculated what I thought were the total 1st Division casualties in the course of the day, and I tried to do it deliberately quite conservatively, and it came up with a casualty number of about 1,300 or so, but that doesn't include all the different units that were attached to the division, and I think that's about 500 more people. And I really think the casualties were probably worse than that. I visited the graves of nearly 100 1st Division soldiers who were buried at the amazing Normandy American Cemetery overlooking Omaha Beach today. And what I hope to do is to kind of bring these guys to life again as real people, that they were young, that they were scared, that they were just ordinary Americans in this circumstance. It's what interests me as an historian. Because as we get seven decades beyond this, it can be a little distance. So I think that it's incumbent upon historians to illustrate who these guys were and what this was really like so much as we possibly can.
To know names like Joe Pinder or Carlton Barrett.
Right, that they kind of can live again.
John McManus, his new book is The Dead and Those About to Die, D-Day, the big red one at Omaha Beach. John, thanks so much.
Thanks so much for having me. It's a real pleasure.
American bourbon producers are now facing a 25% tariff for exports to Mexico. Mexico announced the tariffs yesterday, and the EU and Canada are threatening similar tariffs after President Trump imposed steel and aluminum tariffs on them last week. This is all being closely watched in Kentucky, where the vast majority of the world's bourbon is produced. Steve Thompson is president of Kentucky Artisan Distillery in Crestwood, Kentucky. Steve, thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much for asking.
And what was your reaction to these tariffs from Mexico and possibly tariffs from other places, including the EU?
Well, it was surprising, very surprising, since this bourbon business has been in renaissance, for the last 4 or 5 years. And, 15 years ago, it was declining. So we were all excited the business was growing. And we've had numerous tax legislation to help improve our status, especially here in Kentucky and the other states. So it was sort of surprising and a damper that right when we're getting going and we're spending a lot of capital money, that all of a sudden it was like the brakes coming on and none of us could figure out what is happening. Why did this happen?
Well, how much do you export to the EU, to Canada, to Mexico? I mean, do you know what the dollar impact will be?
I would say that out of here, probably 20% of our business is exported. Now, we do a lot of really high-end product, and so people are used to paying $40 or $50 for a bottle of bourbon, and if it costs $50 or $60, it won't deter them. But on our lower-end products that sell for $30, $25 a bottle, an increase will definitely cause our customers perhaps to shift to a different brand or something of a different quality. We think probably it could impact us as much as 10% in sales overall.
And what will you do about that? Are you going to have to go out and look for new customers or what?
Well, new customers or probably new markets. More than 50% of the bourbon that's produced today in Kentucky is sold overseas.
Hmm.
So I think that we'll have to see which of the markets are impacted with the tariffs. And some of those that aren't impacted, we probably will do a more marketing in those countries to make up for the business we're losing in the impacted countries.
Now, Mexico's economic minister said this week that these goods were chosen to send a political message, that they picked bourbon to send a political message, perhaps to the Republican Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell from Kentucky, who said this week, basically, you got my attention.
Yes.
Do you feel like your industry has been caught up in politics?
Oh, definitely. Unfortunately, there's got to be winners and losers and in any kind of battle like this. And maybe the aluminum companies and the steel companies are winners, but with every winner, there's a loser. And certainly we came out on the losing end. Mitch McConnell is here, has been fighting against the tariffs, I believe. And it's a Republican-controlled, the governor is Republican, and so it's a very business-oriented state. So whether you're Republican or Democrat, I think it hurts everybody. I think it was a message a negotiating tool by Trump, who likes to do this kind of negotiating. And
but shouldn't McConnell or, I mean, somebody else, but especially McConnell, have been able to talk to President Trump and talk him out of doing this if it's going to hurt people in Kentucky?
Apparently he wasn't able to. Apparently that McConnell feels that being on the side of Trump is probably more important than being on the side of the bourbon manufacturers. The the Louisville area is primarily not a, which is the northern part of the state, is generally not much of a McConnell fan. He gets most of his votes from the southern Kentucky. And the southern Kentucky area is probably very pro-Trump. So it goes back to that we're still fighting the war, civil war here, with the North and the South. It's always been that way, with the South part of the state voting one way and the northern part of the state perhaps voting a different way.
And the northern part drinking bourbon, and what do the people in the south of Kentucky drink?
Primarily the people in southern Kentucky probably drink Coke.
Okay. Well, let me ask you one more thing, which is, what makes a really good Kentucky bourbon?
Well, I think there's a lot of it. I think we all use the same corn and wheat and rye and barley. And the other thing is the weather here. It's extremely hot in the summer and humid and extremely cold in the winter, which drives the bourbon in and out of the wood in the barrels. And so a good bourbon, there's a lot of extract, wood extract in it that gives it that flavor. So this is an ideal place for bourbon. And also the support for the bourbon business, we all support each other. It's more like a club, all the manufacturers rather than competitors. And so it's our main, one of our main sources of the economy is obviously bourbon and perhaps racing and so on. So it's a very good place to be here. I'm not from here. I've been here 30 years, and I was with another company in the north, and this certainly is a different environment down here in the south.
That's Steve Thompson, who is president of Kentucky Artisan Distillery. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for asking me.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.